You can trace a line between many of the most significant protests in civil rights history, finding the connections from one to the next. And you might find that the line starts in Baton Rouge with one bus boycott. It became a template for the movement. This is the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail podcast, a series that explores some of the most significant events of the movement that happened in the state and how they changed American history. Last episode, we explored the legal battles to integrate schools. As those lawsuits stretched on, another arm of the movement took shape in cities around Louisiana. A new generation of college students became impatient with what was happening in the courts, and they wanted to take action.
They actually went inside the stores and they started to stage sit-in protests at lunch counters.
They were trying to bring about needed change.
This episode, we follow the growth of the nonviolent protests that helped desegregate Louisiana. The story of the Baton Rouge bus boycott starts with a new preacher at the city's oldest church. It was 1949, and Pastor T.J. Jemison had just arrived in town. The leaders of Mount Zion Baptist Church had recruited him to shepherd the congregation into a beautiful new building.
Jemison was from an elite ministerial family from Alabama. He understood the ideas of civil rights. He was born into this.
That was historian Charlene Senegal Dequeer. She says Jemison had ideas for progress that extended beyond church construction. He wanted to focus on making public transportation in the city fair for everyone.
He saw for the first time, too, just buses after buses passing with Black people just crowded up standing in the back, and the white section was completely empty.
Invariably, I would see buses going down into South Baton Rouge, and as they passed the church, and on those buses were maids and cooks and so forth.
This is from a 1995 oral history of Jemison, stored at Louisiana State University.
I thought it was terrible that they could work all day for white folks and couldn't sit down on a bus. They could put their bags, their bundles, in the seat, but they couldn't put their bodies.
Jemison didn't challenge the buses immediately. He worked within the system at Baton Rouge, led voter registration drives, and lobbied for new and better schools in his community. But then, in January of 1953, the city bus company raised its fares from 10 cents up to 15 cents.
This increase of 5 cents, it really was a lot at the time. It was a lot.
The higher fare for unfair treatment was too much for Jemison. But to address it, he once again worked within the system.
What he did was he went to the city council and he said, you know, something needs to change.
And something surprising happened at the city council in this segregated southern city.
City council heard our plea and thought that certainly that was right, that Black people should be able to sit down on front seats and all the seats. They passed an ordinance, Ordinance 222.
He won. Ordinance 222 mandated that all bus riders could have a seat at the front of the bus. Problem solved. Right? Well, no.
The bus drivers, they did not like this at all.
Bus drivers ignored the order. They acted like it didn't exist. For months, despite Ordinance 222, not everyone could sit on the bus. Things came to a head in June. The way T.J. Jemison recalled it, it started with a bus driver who forced Black women to get up from their seats.
He made the ladies get up. And it so happened I was coming past that way, and I saw the confusion, and I went out, and he told them they couldn't sit down, and I got up on the bus and told them they could. And we had difficulty.
The bus driver flagged a policeman. Jemison produced a copy of Ordinance 222 that he kept in his pocket. The officer sided with Jemison, not the bus driver. The women sat back down, and the bus driver was suspended. So the next day, bus drivers announced they were going on strike. They went on strike for 4 days and won. The state attorney general announced Ordinance 222 was illegal. The bus drivers returned to work. But the next morning, as they drove their routes, something had changed. They found their buses empty. In many Baton Rouge neighborhoods, their usual passengers, instead of boarding, turned their backs. TJ Jemison had successfully organized a bus boycott.
Jemison decided that, again, something needed to be done.
And this time, he was not going to work within the system.
There needed to be a mass movement where African-American people came together to try and combat what was happening. So he had this mass meeting at his church, and that pretty much birthed it, the Baton Rouge bus boycott.
Over the next 8 days, more than 14,000 residents refused to ride the buses of Baton Rouge.
This bus boycott was not just a church thing. It was a thing for the community. All those people came together. They collected money. And then the next Sunday, I believe, it was almost $3,800 collected in efforts to create this boycott.
With that money, Jemison and the other leaders had a means for people to get to work while avoiding the bus.
Out of that came the free car rides, and they would pick up riders who would normally ride the bus. And there was enough money to where if anything happened to the cars, if they need tires, if they needed gas, anything, it came out of that $3,800 that was collected.
The fleet included town cars, even an ambulance. Local gas stations sold fuel to them at wholesale prices.
We had at one time we had as many as 75 cars that ran up and down the bus route.
The boycott lasted only 8 days. Jemison called a halt. The city council already felt pressure to offer a new rule. The rule wasn't as sweeping as Ordinance 222 had been, but it made more of the bus available to all passengers, and the drivers said they would abide by it. It was a step toward integration, and that result undersells the real legacy of the Baton Rouge bus boycott. TJ Jemison and the boycotters had shown a way to force change, not just through court battles, but with direct action.
This was just amazing. I mean, he was really thinking far beyond Baton Rouge.
Because after this boycott, other protest leaders had a template to follow.
I mean, he gave the blueprint to Martin Luther King.
We moved out of Baton Rouge. The next place was Montgomery.
And according to Norman Robinson, former New Orleans TV reporter and anchor,
the bus boycott in Baton Rouge is considered the start of the modern civil rights movement.
Coming up on the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail podcast, how the nonviolent movement spread throughout the state. Taking a pause here to say that if you're interested in following the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail from New Orleans to Shreveport to Baton Rouge and many other places in the state, go to LouisianaCivilRightsTrail.com or CivilRightsTrail.com. It's a great way to learn more about the sites and begin planning your trip. Okay, back to the story. 2 years after the Baton Rouge bus boycott, two states away in Montgomery, Alabama, a woman named Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus. She was arrested, and her arrest was a spark for the Montgomery bus boycott. And the organizers of that boycott selected the 26-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. to lead their effort.
So Martin Luther King is asked, and the first thing he does is he reaches out to Jemison.
TJ Jemison, remember, had led the boycott in Baton Rouge.
He called him and he said, "What can I do?" And so Jemison basically gave him the blueprint for everything.
King and other boycott leaders organized carpools, raised money, and engage the community using the model that Baton Rouge provided.
That was the day that we started a bus protest which literally electrified the nation. And that was the day when we decided that we were not going to take segregated buses any longer.
At the end of it, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the city's bus system would be integrated. It was a victory for civil rights in the United States. A few months after the Montgomery bus boycott, its architects and other civil rights organizers from around the South met in New Orleans, hosted by Pastor A.L. Davis at the New Zion Baptist Church.
So there's this huge meeting at New Zion Baptist Church in Central City. Martin Luther King is there. Jemison is there. A.L. Davis is there. You have Avery Alexander. You have all of the who's who's in Southern ministerial pastoral leadership.
Xavier University historian Charlene Senegal DeQueer says they arrived with a plan.
You know what? We need to establish a larger organization that is going to be like an umbrella organization for all of the Southern ministers throughout, you know, the United States.
They would coordinate boycotts and other nonviolent protest activities throughout the South. The organization they solidified at this meeting was eventually called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They elected as its leader the young minister who'd coordinated the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin Luther King Jr. And they appointed several officers from around Louisiana. They selected T.J. Jemison as a group secretary, and A.L. Davis, their host, became a vice president. You can trace a line from that event, the formation of the SCLC, to new civil rights activity from around Louisiana and the South. The participants from the meeting returned to their cities, newly invigorated to lead more aggressive actions against segregation. In Shreveport, Pastor C.O. Simpkins organized his city's bus boycott, using the model from Baton Rouge and Montgomery. Baptist churches such as Old Galilee and Little Union were hubs for the city's movement, and their respective pastors, E.E. Jones and C.C. McLean, encouraged activism. Here is Carolyn Jones, daughter of E.E. Jones.
They were trying to bring about needed change. You deserve to be able to drink from any water fountain, use any restroom, go to any schools.
The NAACP and the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, would meet at Evergreen Baptist Church to plan protests. Even unconventional sites became rallying points, such as Shreveport's Modern Beauty Shop. Cosmetologists Ann Brewster and Mamie Love Wallace gave haircuts and makeovers while quietly combating voter suppression laws.
Are you registered to vote? Was a regular question. As I sat in that chair as a little girl, do you need help with the test? Because there was that literacy test. You had to know how old you were on the day that you took a test. You had to take it on your birthday.
Back in Baton Rouge, T.J. Jemison began organizing a new form of protest on a new target.
The lunch counters. We had to desegregate the lunch counters.
Students from Southern University staged sit-ins at lunch counters at department stores like Woolworths and McCrory's, as well as a Greyhound bus station. The students entered these segregated places in shifts. Many were arrested. The university expelled a dozen of them. That led to mass protests, a march to the state capitol, and students boycotting classes. But the most significant outcome of this protest was from the court cases that followed. One of the expelled students was named John Garner. He sued, challenging his arrest, as did several other students.
And all of these sit-ins were consolidated into the case Garner versus Louisiana and progressed to the United States Supreme Court.
John Garner's daughter, Joan.
It was the first case that resulted from the sit-in demonstrations in the 1960s.
The landmark case overturned the student's arrest. It was the first decision to challenge the constitutionality of state laws that tried to prevent sit-ins as protests. Over in New Orleans, another group of activists inspired by the meeting were about to launch their own successful boycott. And that boycott would lead to a chain reaction in Louisiana's civil rights history.
Everything was connected. There is a connection between every single thing that happened in Louisiana. And although, you know, if you look at what was happening nationally, it seems as though New Orleans was following a national trend, but they were actually setting their own trend.
Canal Street in New Orleans is a wide boulevard of luxury shops, movie theaters, hotels, streetcars, parades. In 1960, it was the city's shopping hub. It still is. But back then, a mile or two west of Canal Street, there was another boulevard of shops and restaurants. This, says Charlene Senegal Dequeer, was the Black Shopping District on Dryad Street.
So Dryad Street was this huge shopping area. You had Black businesses, you had Jewish businesses, insurance companies, doctor's offices, tailors, restaurants. Everything was there on Dryad Street.
It was a bustling mecca of commerce. It was like the place for African Americans to go shopping.
Norman Robinson is a former New Orleans TV reporter and anchor.
They would dress up to go. It's like going downtown, you know. That was their version of downtown.
On Dryad Street, unlike Canal Street where segregation reigned, all shoppers could enter stores from the front and eat at the lunch counters. They could try on clothes before buying them. They could return goods. Even so, the district was by no means free of discrimination. And so, in late 1959, an unusual group began meeting at the Dryad Street YMCA. They were discussing what action might bring about change, says retired Tulane University historian Lawrence Powell.
Their idea was to, in some of these Black shopping districts, they wanted to open up the employment to more Black workers, especially checkout clerks.
The group included church leaders such as A.L. Davis, the pastor at New Zion. It included Henry Mitchell of the NAACP and Reverend Avery Alexander. But also in the group were some young students from local colleges.
And they formed what was called then the Consumers League of Greater New Orleans. And their aim was to stop the discrimination of employment on Dryad Street.
They tried to negotiate with the store owners of Dryad Street to hire all workers. But the talks didn't go anywhere. They needed to take direct action.
What they decided was that they were going to hold a boycott. And the boycott was going to happen during the week leading up to Easter, because the kids, of course, they needed new dresses, new hats, gloves, all those things. And they would all go and shop on Dryad Street.
But not in 1960. On Good Friday, the stores were empty. Their usual customers were outside, holding signs.
They started to picket and boycott, and they were successful.
They did have a modicum of success.
The boycott led to about 30 jobs, a small number, so the picketing continued for months. But other stores refused to hire all workers. The busy district became quiet rather than integrate its workforce.
Dryad Street really never recovered a whole lot of the economic impact that happened during that time.
The Dryad Street boycott did not achieve the result its organizers intended. But it arguably had a more important effect. The months of boycotting gave momentum for a new civil rights push. Activists turned their eye to New Orleans' largest and segregated shopping hub. They turned to Canal Street. Aretha Castle Haley was a 21-year-old in 1960, a college student. In fact, she was one of the students who'd helped plan the Dryad Street boycott. That had shown her the power direct action could have.
There was a certain kind of consciousness and awareness that was raised about just the way things were here.
This is her recollection from an oral history in 1978 at Tulane University. After the boycott, Aretha Castle Haley wanted to do more.
There were a couple of us, three or four other students, and we talked about the kinds of things that we wanted to do.
Haley and the other students formed their own organization, the New Orleans Chapter of CORE. CORE was a major national civil rights organization that at that point lacked a presence in Louisiana's largest city. Haley and the new chapter led by Xavier student Rudy Lombard of CORE wanted to up the pace of civil rights activity. They would meet at St. James AME Church, and they planned a protest on Canal Street.
Canal Street was like the Mall of America. I mean, it had the best shops, the best clothes.
But it wasn't open to everyone. CORE began picketing, as they had on Dryad Street. They also began to sit in at segregated lunch counters.
They actually went inside the stores, and they started to stage sit-in protests at lunch counters.
First, CORE chose the lunch counter at Woolworth's on Canal Street. They walked into the store and sat down at the lunch counter quietly for 4 hours. Then, police arrested them. It was a surprise. Woolworth's had a policy against calling the police, but the mayor of New Orleans and other leaders wanted to crush protests that could further hurt the city's commerce. That makes what happened next more courageous. 1 week later, Aretha Castle Haley and three other students walked into another department store down the street called McCrory's.
I can't tell you how it came down to that, the four of us. It basically, of course, had to do, we were the four at that time, felt that we could make the decision to do it. We knew it was going to result in going to jail. I mean, that wasn't just a little easy thing to talk about doing.
The group of four students walked to the lunch counter and sat down. The restaurant told them to leave. They refused. The manager closed the lunch area. He shut off the lights. Still, they sat there quietly. Next, the police came and arrested all four. Haley remembers her next day walking into work, a job at a hotel.
When I went to work, they had my paycheck waiting for me. They told me, take that paycheck and don't ever come back anymore.
But the arrest sparked a mass movement. It outraged other civil rights groups. The Consumers League announced its support for the CORE members and picketing. The Youth Council of the NAACP picketed Woolworth's, and so began more than 2 years of demonstrations on Canal Street. Meanwhile, Haley and the others who sat in with her were charged with criminal anarchy for their protests. A court sentenced them to at least 60 days in jail. They appealed. Their case traveled all the way to the Supreme Court. There, the justices overturned the conviction. It was a major national victory, a precedent against segregation laws. Ultimately, newsman Norman Robinson says the legacy of the New Orleans chapter of CORE, the Consumers League, and the other homegrown civil rights organizations is clear.
These groups that formed out of New Orleans were, you know, they were serious, they were committed, they would not be denied even in the face of arrests and all of the laws that the city fathers dreamed up to throw at them to say that they were violating the laws. They kept going, they kept moving, and, you know, here we are today. Thanks to them.
You can trace a line through the civil rights activism that occurred in the 1950s across the nation, connecting one event to the next. That line crisscrosses Louisiana. The Baton Rouge bus boycott inspired Dr. King in Montgomery. Pastors in New Orleans and across the South founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The attendees of that meeting spurred new actions around the South, including Shreveport and New Orleans. Then it was college students who picked up the banner. In New Orleans, CORE members began the Canal Street boycotts. We haven't even mentioned the Freedom Rides. Xavier University took a risk and housed civil rights activists who'd ridden integrated buses on a journey through segregated states. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, Louisiana civil rights activists inspired and led new action that reverberated across the South and continues today. Its legal battles resulted in landmark cases and the direct action by famous civil rights leaders and student activists helped create lasting change. Coming up on episode 2, the civil rights icon James Farmer and what happened to him when he came to support protests in Plaquemine, Louisiana.
So we are marching all over the country, you see. We have many weapons. One great weapon is our own bodies as we march and we picket and we sit in all over the country. You have power. You have found that power.
After listening to this podcast, follow the actual Louisiana Civil Rights Trail throughout the state. Go to LouisianaCivilRightsTrail.com or CivilRightsTrail.com to learn more about the sites and begin planning your trip. In this episode, we heard from historians Charlene Senegal DeQueer and Lawrence Powell, former news anchor Norman Robinson, Carolyn Jones, and Joan Garner, and oral history accounts from T.J. Jemison and Aretha Castle Haley. I'm Marlene Gordon. The Louisiana Civil Rights Trail podcast is sponsored by the Louisiana Office of Tourism and the U.S. Civil Rights Trail Marketing Alliance.